is a
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There's been a rash of violence involving young people around the country in recent months. Video of a high school student being beaten to death in Chicago a few weeks ago was horrific. In fact, that city and others, including Charlotte, are witnessing a growth in violence perpetrated against and by young people, and it has adults scrambling to figure out how to curb it. This week, national experts are converging on Charlotte for a conference sponsored by SAVE, Students Against Violence Everywhere. And three of the participants join us for the hour. Dr. Pamela Riley is Executive Director of Students Against Violence Everywhere, and she joins us by phone. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. And in our Spirit Square studio, Drs. David Jacobs and Elizabeth Peterson-Vita. Dr. Jacobs is a medical doctor and associate director of the trauma service at Carolina's Medical Center. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
And Dr. Peterson-Vita is a licensed psychologist and clinical director for Area Mental Health's Provided Services Division. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Mike.
As we go through the program, you may have questions or comments of your own, and here's how you reach us. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or every other way known to man at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Are the incidents that we have been reading about and seeing on television in the last few weeks, the one, for instance, that I referred to in Chicago, the young man in Charlotte who was gunned down in August as he came home from visiting his girlfriend, are they just coincidences in that they occurred so closely together, or are, and there's another instance in Rock Hill over the weekend, are they just occurring closely together or as a coincidence, or is there a rise in youth violence across the land? Let me begin with Dr. Riley.
Well, when we look at the school-associated deaths around the country, they're actually on the decrease over the past few years. But what we are seeing is when they do occur, they are much more violent. The civility among students has been lost. We're seeing students who have no empathy for each other, students who are taking bullying to a new level of using technology and making this something that the whole world sees. And it is a situation that we have to get a handle on. We must do some things immediately so that this does not get worse.
We're obviously getting through to some young people. If the incidence of violence among young people is down overall, it's just that what remains is becoming more callous and more violent. We're getting through to some and obviously not getting through to others. Is that fairly an accurate way to say that?
Yes, it is. And that's one reason for the importance of Students Against Violence Everywhere, or SAVE. Our organization has been around since 1989. And it is an organization that is a peer-to-peer opportunity for young people to work together to keep themselves from being victims, to deal with conflicts in positive ways, and to provide service to their school and to their community. You know, we think about peer pressure being negative, peer pressure causing young people to do the wrong thing, to do inappropriate behaviors. But SAVE believes that the strength of young people and involving youth in this issue so that we can come up with lasting, real solutions is to have those young people a part of those solutions and helping us to come up with things that actually will work. Peer pressure through SAVE's eyes can be seen as a positive. Young people helping and influencing other young people to choose the correct path, to be able to choose appropriate and healthy behaviors rather than inappropriate and unhealthy behaviors.
So from a psychologist's point of view, Dr. Peterson-Vita, what's going on here? Why have we gotten through to some young people in order to decrease the amount of youth violence, and yet the ones that are still involved in it seem to be much more violent, much less empathetic toward their peers, et cetera, than in the past? What's happening here, do you know?
I think that that's a huge issue, and I think some of that is what Dr. Jacobs will also address,
right,
also looking at some trends. But certainly we see among some youth that they are very inured to violence, and I think that of the crux of that, the issue of being exposed to a great deal of violence and from a very early age and becoming, if you will, desensitized to it, and also if that's what's been role modeled for them, around them, by what you would think would be responsible adults, perhaps, and not always responsible, and that they take that in and that becomes the norm, and where there may be some reinforcement of a violent response to conflict. We don't get rid of conflict in society. We'll always have conflict right. between people and among people and groups of people. It's how you handle conflict that becomes the yeah. issue.
What are you seeing in the trauma area when people come in with injuries? What kind of, are you seeing a different kind of injury, more violent injuries, more incidences of violent injuries? What are you seeing?
I would not say that we're seeing more violent injuries, perhaps over the last 8 to 10 years. Certainly we're seeing more gun-related injuries over the last 15 to 20 years as guns have become a more popular means of committing violence. And so we know that mortality is a lot higher when people are using guns. But as you can tell in the incidents in Chicago, you can still do a significant amount of damage mm-hmm. without the use of guns. And so kids, unfortunately, are becoming creative in the types of violence that they're perpetrating. But certainly the gun is still the major issue.
Creative because they can't get their hands on a gun, and they would use one if they could, but if they can't, they'll figure out a way to do significant
Absolutely.
Damage.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Almost anything can be a weapon now.
What are they thinking? I mean, what drives that? Finding a way to perpetrate violence, no matter what.
I think some of that goes back to what society may look at, or subcultures among society, where that, you know, to be big and bad and violent could be something that is encouraged among children. And I say children because of the youth sometimes that we're talking about. And I think sometimes it's something which is considered and thought about in terms of perpetration, but many times also it's very impulsive.
I think you used the term inured to violence mm-hmm. a second ago, and I'm just curious what that means, really. Is it that they, because there was an incident a couple of years ago where a child shot somebody and then said afterward, I didn't know it would hurt that bad. They see it on television and the actor gets up and walks away, or they see mm-hmm. him on the next show and he's just fine.
Right.
Is it that they don't understand the reality of what they're doing, or is it that they've seen so much of it they just don't care?
I think it's both, and I think sometimes it depends on the age of the child. Developmentally, in young children, certainly they don't have an appreciation for what this means because of what they see, and someone can get up and walk away, and the finality of death or the reality of the damage that's done by violent means is really not too apparent to young children. And older children also have seen so many incidents that they just become, to use the word I said before also, desensitized.
And some of this is anecdotal, but I've seen interviews on television with young men who are 16, 15, 17 years old, who tell the reporter, well, I'm not going to live to be 30 years old. I'm going to die well before that. So if you really believe that about your own mortality, doesn't that devalue another person's life in your eyes?
Absolutely. And, you know, the issue of exposure, certainly to this generation of kids, cannot be understated. There was a study that came out this week that's now showing that 60% of kids are having significant exposures to violence. When you sit back and you look at the different types of violence, whether it's video games, whether it's music, whether it's TV, whether it's watching a football game, watching their parents fight on the sidelines of football games, mm-hmm. the amount of violence that kids are being exposed to nowadays is significant. And kids are just, it's becoming a way of life. It's nothing new. And so it's business as usual.
Dr. Riley, the statistics that Dr. Jacobs just alluded to were released this week by the Justice Department, and it says more than 60% of the children surveyed were exposed to violence in the past year, either directly or indirectly. Nearly half of children and adolescents were assaulted at least once. More than 1 in 10 were injured as a result. Nearly 1/4 were the victim of a robbery. 1 in 16 was victimized sexually. From what you know as a national leader in this area, do those numbers seem high or about right to you?
Well, those numbers unfortunately seem about right. And what we're seeing is that our young people are reflecting, as has already been mentioned, what they're seeing in society. Our schools are a reflection of our society. And I sometimes think that we ask more of our children than we're willing to do ourselves as adults. And I think it's already been mentioned, the young people are experiencing, they're seeing it, and we all need to do a better job in how we handle conflicts, teachers at school, teacher-to-teacher situations, a teacher with a young person in a classroom, how is that situation handled, and what kind of message does that send to our young people?
In the aftermath of the Chicago incident, Attorney General Eric Holder said that we are looking at an epidemic of youth violence, and yet you have said, Dr. Riley, that we actually have seen a decline in youth violence over the past decade. So which is the more accurate statement?
Well, the numbers, the federal numbers do lag behind, and what we need to see on the federal level is a better way of comparable statistics. You know, each state has its own listing for crime and violence. They keep up with crime and violence by school district. But on the federal level, we have the number of guns that are located in schools, but we really don't have good numbers that will help us to see what's going on in schools really, where it is happening. Is it happening at bus stops? Is it happening in certain areas of the school that we can focus on? Is it happening before school, after school? Is it all of that? And we need to know exactly what is happening, and then we can focus in on the problem of helping to solve that.
Why don't we have those numbers?
It has been, states have been resistant to getting much of that information. Schools are hesitant to provide information because they might be seen as a persistently dangerous school. So what we have to do is change that so that school districts see and schools see that, yes, we need to identify the problem in order to make things better.
Isn't withholding that information irresponsible? Isn't it endangering young people?
I don't think it's a matter of withholding. It might be a matter of interpretation of what constitutes a fight, for instance. Versus an assault.
You have
some different ways of interpreting it depending on law enforcement or a school official.
Dr. Jacobs.
Yeah, I think we may be talking about two different things. I think we're talking about school-related violence and we're talking about youth violence, and those two things are not necessarily the same. We do know, looking at national numbers, that youth violence is down. It peaked around in the early 90s and has come down nationally. I think what we're seeing now is a greater recognition of youth violence, certainly with people with their cell phones and videotaping these, and these becoming widely broadcast within minutes. I think the public has become more aware of some of these incidents, and particularly the ones that occur around school time. We've always looked at school as being sort of a safe haven, where we can trust that our kids are going to be safe. But I think these last several incidents have sort of opened the eyes of many people that now what we're seeing in the streets is being carried into the schools. And I think that's why there's a lot more attention being brought to the issue now.
I want to explore this idea of school versus other kinds of youth violence in a second and come back to the idea that violent acts can be captured and instantly broadcast around the world and why that isn't a deterrent. Talk to Dr. David Jacobs, Dr. Elizabeth Peterson-Vita, and Dr. Pamela Riley about all this. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by Charlotte Latin School with an admissions open house for all grades October 22nd at 9:30 a.m. Financial assistance is available. Details and registration, 704-846-7207. And by Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates with 5 area offices offering minimally invasive spine surgery and complex spine procedures, including artificial disc surgery, on the web at carolinaneurosurgery.com. Well, today's children are certainly connected. They're connected by email, by Twitter, by cell phones, to their video games, to their computers, to their televisions, but they are increasingly disconnected from nature. They have what Richard Louv calls nature deficit disorder, and that's just not a gimmicky name. It actually has significant impact on children's lives. We'll talk about that tomorrow morning at 9.
The fourth deadly attack in just over a week in Pakistan. An update on a suicide car bomb that killed dozens in a market in northwest Pakistan, and fears the Taliban will target areas once thought secure. The Diane Rehm Show, Tuesday.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 FM WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about youth violence and what's going on around the country here in Charlotte and down in Rock Hill and in Chicago. It seems to be everywhere, although the incidence, as we've heard, is actually down. The acts of violence seem to be getting more grotesque. Dr. David Jacobs is a medical doctor, associate medical director of the trauma service at Carolinas Medical Center. He's with us in our studio, along with Dr. Elizabeth Peterson-Vita, clinical director of Area Mental Health's Provided Services Division, and Dr. Pamela Riley joins us by phone. She's executive director of Students Against Violence Everywhere. Dr. Jacobs, before the break, you talked about how some of these violent incidences are being captured on cell phone cameras and immediately put on YouTube and transmitted around the world. And I'm just curious, and maybe Dr. Peterson-Vita is the one to ask about this because she's the psychologist. Why isn't that? Because there are cameras on street corners now. Big cities have cameras everywhere. Charlotte has cameras downtown. And we've had incidences at 4th of July celebrations in the past several years, not last year, but the year before last, where there, not only were there the security cameras, but the television station cameras were downtown. And yet people engaged in violent activity in front of the cameras. Why isn't that a deterrent? People can be readily identified.
They can be readily identified, but we're living in a society where getting attention from those, even however inappropriately may be, can sometimes stimulate
behavior. Is all that about?
Because at times, how regardless of how negative and inappropriate we might think, it's still the 15 minutes of fame, and people will still do that. And in some subcultures, you know, youth might think that that's something to be, I don't know if I want to use proud, but you get that attention. And attention is one of the greatest stimulants known to man.
That attention, that craving for attention, tells me they're not getting normal attention from normal channels. Would you think that's relatively accurate?
I think that can often be the case. It's the same as when children, or it doesn't always have to be children, when people act out, various kinds of behavioral acting out, or what we would consider not the best behavior, but it gets a lot of attention, and sometimes that just perpetuates it.
And the research does show us that young people who are connected in a positive way to their home or to school, to someone at school, they're less likely to be involved in inappropriate behavior, which is one reason for the importance of SAVE in a school. Young people who are SAVE members or influenced by the SAVE activities in a school are less likely to be involved in the kinds of incidents that we have seen. So that's why we're very proud to have the SAVE Summit coming to Charlotte this weekend on Saturday. It's a national opportunity to bring this organization back to the grassroots of the community of Charlotte.
You're actually bringing it back to where it started. It started in 1989. You've already told us that, but it actually started at West Charlotte High School, where this summit will be taking place in the response to the death of a teenager who lost his life while trying to break up a fight at a party. And this is, so I guess this is kind of a homecoming for the organization. So after 20 years, how would you assess, Dr. Riley, the impact of SAVE on youth violence? Will you take credit for some of this decrease in youth violence that's occurred over the last decade?
I think we certainly can take credit for that. There are situations where violent acts have been averted because a young person did the right thing and told a responsible adult that they saw a situation that might end up being a tragedy, like a young person with a gun in their backpack, for instance, or a situation where there is a real strong conflict between individuals, and the SAVE chapter was able to work through that. Certainly we're not Pollyanna-ish enough to say that we can do that in all situations. But a saved chapter can decrease the potential for violence occurring. Can we guarantee it won't occur with the saved chapter there? No, they're risk in life. There are no guarantees. But there are things that saved chapters do that help to promote that nurturing, trusting environment in a school, which makes that violent act less likely.
There has been a trend toward formation of gangs. It's crept out of Los Angeles and is slowly creeping across the country, and it certainly started up. There are certainly incidences of gangs here and gang violence in Charlotte and the surrounding region. Is this part, is this desire to belong to a gang part of this craving for attention, this craving to feel like you belong to something bigger than yourself?
I think that it is in large measure, and in terms of the attention, and if there has been something lacking in that child's life in terms of attention, a sense of belonging, a sense of family, if you will, even taking a broad interpretation of family, that the gang provides that, and often unconditional acceptance.
Yeah. But so how do you combat that? Because to belong, it would seem to me, if you're attracted to that kind of group activity, gang activity, your mind is in a different place than somebody who would be attracted to being on a softball team or a football team or in the cheerleaders or going to a SAVE meeting and trying to organize and teach other students how to be nonviolent. How do you take some of the attractiveness away from gangs and put it on these other activities?
Well, I think the other thing to keep in mind, and we'll come back to that, but the other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of these kids don't have those opportunities. A lot of those the cheerleaders and the football, the after-school programs, a lot of these are being cut because of financial issues. And so those options aren't there. Unfortunately, the gang options are there. They're in the neighborhoods. They're in the schools. And so, again, the peer pressure issue comes to bear. And it's a very, very powerful attraction of particularly for young men, mm-hmm. To have this, to know that somebody has your back, particularly when you don't have that at home. And so I'm not a gang expert, but I can tell you that I think it stems from the fact that these kids are missing things at home in their neighborhoods that they're finding in these gangs.
And Dr. Rell, I like your take on that too, because you're actively involved in steering young people away from violence and into other activities. How do you make it attractive?
Well, I agree with what has just been said, and what we need to do in schools is to have those opportunities for young people so that they do feel a part, draw them in to activities. Adults in schools who have the skills to pinpoint those individuals with those particular needs and be able to draw them into to activities structured that they need. The same thing with families. Help for our families, our parents, so that they are able to recognize those early warning signs and deal with it before it becomes a situation almost for no return.
But once you're in a gang, this is all anecdotal once again, and it's driven by exposure to this on television and in television dramas, so I'm wondering if it's even true. But once you're in a gang, can you extricate yourself safely, or were you once a gang member, always a gang member in the eyes of the members of the gang?
Well, I think you can extricate yourself, and Gang of One here in Charlotte, I think, has done an excellent job of helping kids make that make that move. But the kid needs to want to do mm-hmm. that. Clearly there's a lot of peer pressure, and sometimes there are physical penalties associated with getting out of the gang. But Gang of One really has had a lot of success in helping kids get out.
This situation in Chicago, I'm going to keep coming back to this because it was just so beyond the pale. It's one thing, it's horrible, but it's one thing to pull the trigger on a gun and shoot and kill somebody. It is another thing to take a stick up and beat them to death. That's a different kind of violence. It takes effort, and it shows a different kind of anger or frustration or whatever you would want to call that emotion. You're the psychologist here.
Mm-hmm. I think that again, sometimes these things are impulsive, and when people lose their filters and are taken over by this violence, you know, it's as if it comes over them, not in a sense of you're at something otherworldly, but I'm reminded from literature of Lord of the Flies, and when people lose, in a way, their protective factors, and then start to act out.
And there's a group dynamic, it would seem to me, too.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you have children individually may engage in acts of violence, but the group, and in terms of losing your identity and your personal responsibility, because it all becomes diffuse over the group, then things are more likely to happen in those circumstances.
Is there anything a person can do to protect themselves from that? I mean, if they find themselves the target of something like that, is there anything that they can do to diffuse the situation, or get away from that? Or was this kid just doomed from the start? I don't know the answer to that. I'm not who to ask the question to.
Yeah, I don't know if any of us.
All right.
Can.
Well,
well, we recommend with students who are being bullied that they pay attention to where they are alone. Don't put themselves in situations where they know, like a back hallway that no one else is in. Stay with your friends. And have a plan for dealing with it. Have some type of your cell phone with you, or other way to call for help if you have time. But that's a very difficult situation.
Yes. Certainly, in some of these instances, and I don't think this applies to the Chicago instance, but certainly in some of these instances, there is aggression on both parts. And we talk to a lot of kids in schools these days, and there really is, at least in their minds, a stigma about not backing down.
Yeah.
About not being perceived as a quote-unquote punk is the word that they sort of use. And they would rather stand and fight, even if that means that they stand a chance of losing. I'm not sure if that means that they would be willing to stand there and die. Mm. But they certainly have an attitude where they cannot walk away from a fight. And that, I think that at some level, we've got to get back to these kids the idea that being a man, it doesn't necessarily mean that you stay and fight, that sometimes walking away and living for another day is a better choice.
When you talk to these kids, what's driving that attitude that I cannot, not, it's not that I won't back down, it's that I cannot afford to back down?
Well, a lot of this, I think, is passed down in the community. I think it is a community norm for some of these kids that being a man means you stand and you fight. A lot of these homes, unfortunately, they are not positive role models. They're not positive male role models. And so they get a lot of their male role modeling from the media, but they also get it from their communities. We go into the schools and we talk about the medical consequences of violence, the things that we see at the hospital. And I'll ask these kids at the end of a presentation, now that you've seen what can happen to you if you get involved in a fight, how many of you could walk away? 20%, maybe 30%. So at some level, and I really do believe that we got to start early, but at some level, these kids have to be shown, and not just told, but they have to be shown and role modeled the fact that they can walk away, and it doesn't mean that you're not masculine, you're not a man.
You used the term in the community a second ago, and that code word for a certain socioeconomic, maybe even racial situation. But youth violence crosses all those boundaries. Different kinds of violence, but it crosses all those boundaries. Am I right?
Sure. But I tend, as a physician, I tend to look at violence as a whole, as a public health problem. If you look at the number of people that die every year, and people talk about these as accidents, we know that there are causes of violence. And so it really is a disease. And when you look at violence like you look at any other disease, it is a disease that predominantly affects young African-American males. Mm-hmm. And I think if you don't admit that to yourself, then you really can't begin to solve the problem.
But then we have even incidents like Columbine, which had nothing to do with African-American males, and that was tragic in a whole different way.
Right. Sure. That's, again, getting back to the school-related violence, and those kinds of episodes seem to capture the attention of the public.
Yeah.
But when you look at the number of kids, and I'm not saying that the kids that died in Columbine are somehow less worthy of the notoriety, but they get a lot of notoriety because of the numbers of kids and because those kinds of episodes don't occur every day. Okay. But if you look at episodes like the Chicago episodes, those episodes do occur every day. And when you look at the total number of kids that die as a result of those kinds of one-on-one or two-on-one kinds of conflicts, those are where I think we really need to be putting our efforts.
You also earlier in this conversation made a distinction between school violence and youth violence, and I'm not sure I understand why it matters that there's a distinction or what the distinction is.
Well, I think as has been said before, it's difficult, number one, to define what school violence is, and because the numbers aren't kept, schools have a vested interest in not necessarily letting you know how many fights have occurred on their campus. So is a fight that occurs on the way to school violence, on the way home? Is a fight that started on Saturday, on Friday at school, and then was completed on Saturday away from school? Is that school violence? So I think we have some difficulties in defining what that is. And I think that's what's caused the public to sort of focus. These were school-age kids. There was a young woman in Charlotte that was shot at a school bus waiting to go to school.
Right.
And again, we've always, as a society, sort of felt that school is a safe place for our kids to be, and now we're finding that that's not the case. And I think that's got a lot of people shaken up.
Dr. Riley, you've already said that youth violence overall is on the decline, but is violence among young women on the incline in your experience?
Yes, it is. And we're finding that girls are more willing now to be involved in fighting, where usually it was a war of words among females. It is becoming more and more physical. One interesting statistic is that we have slightly more female members of SAVE across the country than we do male. So it's interesting that young people, that the females are becoming more violent, but we're also seeing a great number of females that are saying, you know, we want our hallways back, our restrooms back, our classrooms back for what they were meant for, and we want to turn this thing around. And I think our whole conversation this morning, we have talked about what we can do, what parents can do, what adults can do, but we need to come back to student involvement, which is what SAVE is all about. Young people involved in coming up with, looking at these issues, seeing what the problems are, and coming up with real workable solutions. So thanks to the Allstate Foundation, we're able to have the summit in Charlotte on Saturday, where young people from across the country will be able to talk about their successes, what has worked, what has not worked, the challenges that they have in dealing with making their school a safer environment that is free of fear, where young people feel safe going to school, and at the same time is conducive to learning. And I think we have to keep that in mind. We think about the security that we can put in place in schools, and that's all important and necessary. We need security. We need law enforcement officers, surveillance cameras to help us. But at the same time, we need to think about relationships, student-to-student relationships. If students do not get along, positive relationships, all the security in the world is not going to prevent incidents from happening.
Dr. Pamela Riley is Executive Director of Students Against Violence Everywhere. She's going to be here for part of that SAVE Summit at West Charlotte High School on Saturday. We're going to lose her now because she has another appointment. I want to thank you for joining us. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by Heartwood Tree Service. 30 years of environmentally conscious certified arborists providing research-based pruning and removal to keep Charlotte's trees safe. Info at 704-525-3066 or heartwoodtree.com. And by the Charlotte Fine Art Show, featuring 125 juried artists from around the globe with artwork personally handmade by the artists. October 24th and 25th at The Park, formerly the Charlotte Merchandise Mart. Details at hotworks.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock, the Diane Rehm Show, the fourth deadly attack in just over a week in Pakistan, an update on the suicide car bomb that killed dozens in a market in northwest Pakistan, and fears that the Taliban and other militants will target areas once thought secure. That's the topic coming up in about 20 minutes here on the Diane Rehm Show on WFAE. Join our conversation now, 704-926-WFAE and at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
On your commute home, you want something different and unexpected, perhaps even something surprising. At All Things Considered, we provide those moments. Every afternoon, we look for the bigger picture behind the day's news. We explore and analyze world events, and we take a break for thoughtful ideas and opinions, and sometimes even fun. All Things Considered, every afternoon from NPR News.
Catch All Things Considered, news you can trust, weekdays from 4 till 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Joining us in our Spirit Square studio, Dr. David Jacobs, MD, Associate Medical Director of Trauma Service at Carolina's Medical Center, and Dr. Elizabeth Peterson Vita, Clinical Director of Erie Mental Health's Provided Services Division. Dr. Pamela Riley was with us earlier in the program. She had to leave for another appointment. She is the Executive Director of Students Against Violence Everywhere, SAVE. We've talked about how violence among young people is on the decline. Yet in 2007-2008, there were 16 school-associated deaths. In 2006-2007, there were 32. In 2005-2006, there were 27. In 2004-2005, there were 39. In 2003-2004, there were 49. And that does not count violence that did not result in death. So what do you make of these numbers? This is at school. These are in schools.
Again, I think that what we're seeing at the schools is sort of a microcosm of what we're seeing in the community. We used to say that a lot of these fights and a lot of these deaths were started in school and carried outside, and I think now we're seeing the reverse. We're seeing some that may be gang-related, some that may be turf-related, but school is no longer viewed, at least by these kids, as a place where violence is taboo. And one of the comments that Dr. Riley made is the importance of kids establishing the tone at their own schools. Adults can do all they want, but what we found that in a lot of schools that have had success with violence, the students themselves have said, enough is enough. We are going to establish an environment where violence is just not tolerated. And once that environment is established, then you can begin to make some progress. But I think a lot of it is being carried from the community into the school.
That leads us to this comment from Joe, who joins us by phone from Stallings. Joe, welcome.
Hi. My comment is that it doesn't take a PhD to figure out what the issues are surrounding this. We live in a kid-centric society where the children rule. They have no respect for their elders or their fellow students. It's all about me, me, me. What we have to do is reestablish discipline, get rid of the cell phones, get rid of all the junk, the extraneous toys that kids just don't need. And people are willing to stand up and establish the fact that, hey, I'm the adult here, you're a child, we will get through this together, but you have to listen to me.
Yeah, what?
And, you know, all this rhetoric back and forth about these children is just, it's mind-numbing. It, you know, it doesn't take a weatherman to know which way the wind blows.
What about that? I mean, you say it has to start with the kids. The adults can do whatever they want. What they can try as they will, but the kids ultimately have to be the final arbiters. Where the hell did that start?
Well, I think one of the things that we've been talking about here, too, are some of the difficulties in the families. And children grow up to be adults and parents. And some of the difficulties that we see are because sometimes there's inadequate parenting. And what we've
But there's always been inadequate parenting. And we didn't have this kind of activity in the school. We didn't have this kind of disrespect of adult authority in the schools. We didn't have it.
Well, I think we have a perfect storm of various factors which have come about in terms of the, in a way, a glorification of violence, deterioration among families and communities and role modeling, all of these pieces. But I think that, and to take at least a part of what your last caller talked about, was to engage families and have parents do parenting and be adequate role models as well. Because kids watch what, incorporate what they see. And so
when you look at these kids' parents on television, these kids who are victims of violence on television, and the reporters go into the home and they talk to these parents, the parents are either surprised or angry at the people who perpetrated the violence. I'm not sure that I have a question here, but it doesn't appear to be. They seem to be innocent victims themselves, they say. They look like responsible people in many cases.
And in many cases they may be, but I do think that what we are seeing is a breakdown of the family. We're seeing, Joe.
Joe,
mm-hmm. Mentioned the role of parents being parents, and mm-hmm. I'm not your friend, I am your parent.
Yeah.
And so even if there is a family in place, which in a lot of communities there isn't, parents are not stepping up. And if they're stepping up, we're seeing parents fighting on sidelines at soccer games and those kind of things and not setting the tone.
And if your child is willing to take a gun and kill someone with it, what power do you have? I mean, I'm the parent, you're the child. That goes out the window. The kid's got a gun.
Well, I think I'm a parent, too. And I think that some of the – if a parent is surprised that their child would take a gun and kill somebody – I think one of the questions you have to ask is that parent really in tune with what's going on with their kids? Typically, we don't see honor students that are putting guns in their backpack and taking and killing people. Mm. Although we are seeing students who are more and more afraid of the environment that they're in, and so they are taking guns for protection.
Where are they getting the guns?
Guns are very, very easy to get. We know that in 40% to 50% of the homes in this town, there are guns. And so that's one place. But when you ask these kids in school, how many of you could get a gun in 15 minutes, 80% of the kids raise their hands. So they can get them from their friends, and they can get them from older folks in the community. They're everywhere.
So if our gun laws were stricter in terms of how you acquire one, not the fact that you have a right to have one, but how you acquire one and what you must do to protect ownership of that gun, if they were stricter, would we have less incidents of gun violence among young people?
Well, absolutely. We would have less incidents of gun violence. Would we have less incidents of violence?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I tend to think that the gun tends to make the playing field very, very level, so that somebody who is 5'2" and 140 pounds is now in the same playing field as somebody who's 290 pounds. Now, mm-hmm. that 140-pound person wouldn't necessarily take a baseball bat and try to beat up that 6'2", 250-pound person. But if they've got a gun, the playing field is a whole lot more level. So I think without guns, there would be less tendency to try to take on somebody who's bigger than you.
Let's go to Rudy in Charlotte. You're on WFAE, Rudy.
Good morning, Mike. Morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just have three comments, and I would like to hear the panel elaborate a little bit on that. I think we took away the draft. I think that has a lot to do in what we're going through today. We took prayer away from school. And, it doesn't matter who you pray to, but we just took it away from school. And also, the American family is really under attack, especially the African-American family. Since 65, Senator Moynihan made comments to that effect, and the numbers are getting worse every day.
How do you see that they're under attack? From where?
I see the traditional family under attack by, I'll give you one of them, for example, gay people adopting children. That just totally throws me off, and something doesn't seem right there. The tax structure is not in favor of the family. It's just a lot of little things that
How can you say that? How can you say that the tax structure is not in favor of the family? It absolutely is in favor of the family.
Well,
if you're single, you're paying a lot more taxes than you are if you're married.
Yeah, but have you not heard of people getting divorced because they get into a threshold where they cannot get certain assistance?
Hmm. Well, that may be true. I have no experience with. Okay, Rudy, thank you for your call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let me go to Dennis in Morrisville. Welcome to the program.
Previous caller talked about how we've become a kid-centric society, and I'm going to put this question out here. I won't give my age, but let me just say this. When I came home from school, I didn't tell my mom or dad that anything that happened bad at school from a teacher, okay? I wouldn't dare, because you know what? I was going to get it again, right, for disrupting the class or whatever it may have been. And now kids go home, tell their – and my wife's a teacher, so I could give you a real-life example that happened this week, but I won't. But this kid went home, and as my wife said, how did she word it? she can call her a liar in the email, but this mother believes the kid. Now, when I was a kid, mom and dad didn't believe me, or a parent, even if it's a single parent home, didn't believe me. Now the parent jumps up and defends their kid, and maybe in a verbally violent or maybe even physically violent way. And so what do we think the kids are going to do?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it keeps coming back to the notion of parents as role models. We've had fights break out at school, and you summon the parents to school to try and solve the problem, and the parents end up fighting in front of the kids.
Right.
And this is that whole issue of exposure to violence. They're seeing it in their homes. They're seeing it in the media. They're seeing it every single place. In fact, I like to challenge kids to actually count the numbers of violent episodes that they encounter every day, whether it's real violence person to person or whether it's media violence. And if you sit down and do that, and including the news, you'll find that these kids are exposed to 50, 60, 70, 80 episodes of violence a day.
But so are you.
Yeah.
So am I.
But I've got a structure in place. I hope I had a structure in place, and we've not talked about the community. Certainly, as one caller earlier said, there is a disintegration of the family, particularly in the African American community.
Okay.
And I'm African American. I want everybody to know that. So you can't dispute those facts. When I was young, if I acted out and my parents weren't home, I had to answer to my neighbors, and so that whole mantra of it takes a village to raise a child, it's a trite saying, but it had meaning in my life, and I think a lot of that is gone.
Let me go back to something that Dennis just brought up, and that is, and this is true because I hear this from teachers all the time, that if somebody gets in trouble in school and the parents are brought in to get involved in the conversation, the parents will stick up for the kid and accuse the teacher of bias. Where does that come from in our society?
I think that's a much more recent phenomenon. I think my experience is similar to that of Dr. Jacobs, is that the teacher had the final say. And I think something is this topsy-turvy aspect that we have where, if you want to say kid-centric, where parents are afraid, so to speak, to not support their kids, or they want to be the kid's friend, and so I'm going to support the kid despite anything else, and to become more combative to other people, sometimes to the point where they have blinders on and, not engaging the other adult or standing up for that structure or whatever the consequence was for the child.
A lot of the problems that we see here, I think, are that kids don't have any training or understanding of how to peacefully resolve mm-hmm. a conflict.
Right.
Why don't they know how to do that? And how difficult is it for them to learn how to do that?
I think that's one of the things that goes back to, if they're growing up in an environment where that is not demonstrated for them at all, and if there's conflict in the family, it erupts into violence. And we have a program, for example, Child Development Community Policing, where we have clinicians paired up with CMPD officers and go to situations where children have been exposed to violence many times. Many times, that's domestic violence situations. And then we do an assessment and short-term intervention, refer the child on if they need more. But in those families, well, there were over 2,000 of those families referred in the past year. Mm-hmm. So you think about that, and that's typically what children see. And very young children, that's what's getting encoded in their brain as the way to respond to a situation where someone displeases you or makes you angry. And so I think that probably all of us can agree that the primary thing is intervention as opposed to treatment. Mm-hmm. And the more that we can do on the intervention side and to help families and their children realize that there are alternatives to violence and impulsive acting out and striking out, that's where we need to go.
Sometimes conflicts can't be resolved. Sometimes we have to agree to disagree.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Is that a difficult concept for young people to grasp?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we've talked about this before. There is a mantra that you've got to stay and you got to fight. I'm not going to be a victim. I'm not going to be a punk. If I walk away, then I'm somehow less of a man.
Mm-hmm.
And the examples are just legion.
Well, let's talk about that. When we're talking about baseball bats and guns, perhaps it is dangerous to back down. I mean, if you back down, you're weak. You're a punk. So why shouldn't I go after you? So how do you resolve that when there is danger involved in backing down and trying to be the one, to trying to be the peacemaker as opposed to the fighter? How much danger are these kids putting themselves in?
I don't think they're putting themselves in any greater danger by trying to de-escalate a situation than they are by staying and fighting. Again, I don't know what the details were with the situation in Chicago. This kid was surrounded by a group of kids, and I think he was physically prevented from walking away.
Yeah.
But certainly, I think that a lot of the gun violence that we see is very impulsive.
Yeah.
They've got a gun. They have an argument. Before they think about it, they pick up the gun and shoot somebody. I think that's different than as you mentioned earlier, the person who's using a bat or base or a pipe or something of that nature. But I think even some of these kids who seem to have a less respect for life would have a problem shooting somebody in the back as they're trying to walk away from an altercation.
I have 30 seconds left, and some of the things I read about this over the weekend indicates to me that they don't understand the consequences of some of these violent activities. It never even occurs to them that there will be consequences or what they will be. So given that, and given the amount of violence that we have, who seems to be having the most effect on decreasing it? Is it parents? Is it teachers? Is it the police? Is it the kids themselves?
I think it's a community. It's all of that. But I would go back. Kids like to affiliate with kids. And I think especially if you can get kids who come together around this, such as SAVE, that can make a huge impact. But the adults, the important adults, have to stand behind them.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Peterson-Vita, Clinical Director of Erie Mental Health's Provided Services Division. Also with us in the studio, David Jacobs, MD, Associate Medical Director of Trauma Service at Carolinas Medical Center, and prior, just a little while ago in the last segment, Dr. Pamela Riley, Executive Director of Students Against Violence Everywhere, SAVE. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.